Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And now we continue our October series, A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition. This is our contribution to the People's Guide to Power series. Our news team has begun in conjunction with this year's elections in New York and New Jersey. What unbalanced power relationships make housing so unaffordable in Greater New York? Decade after decade, even as every New York mayor announces historic affordable housing programs and every New Jersey governor comes with a plan to get property taxes under control. We're doing segments on these things throughout the month of October here on The Brian Lehrer Show, A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition. Now, during this first week of the series, we're going back in time to set the scene with some of the history for today's unaffordability crisis, or that leads up to today's unaffordability crisis, with the help of our talented friends at the WNYC Archives. Today, we'll set the Wayback Machine for 1962. The occasion is the dedication of the Penn South Co-op apartment complex in Chelsea on Manhattan's West Side.
I believe that when the dust of the housing battles has settled and the din of ideological welfare has subsided, this cooperative nonprofit village will go down in history as one of the very best.
New York's master planner Robert Moses at the Penn South dedication, never mind that he meant ideological warfare, but said ideological welfare. Governor Nelson Rockefeller spoke at the dedication too. And in a city of renters, Penn South was supposed to represent a new model of affordable housing geared toward people of ordinary means owning a piece of Manhattan Island, if only a few hundred square feet in a high-rise apartment building. And notably, it was not just about private individuals owning, but a subsidized apartment complex made possible by a union. Here's 2 minutes of Governor Rockefeller, who really sounds like a Rockefeller Republican in this clip, when he addresses the issue of government helping people afford housing. And notice in this clip that he even talks about income segregation.
The problem of the ownership of a home in cooperative apartments is for many thousands of people in this city a very difficult one because they can't get the funds for a down payment. And therefore, this year the legislature passed a program which permits the state to finance the down payments for individuals who want to buy cooperative apartments. With a $200 down payment, the state will finance the remaining on a 10-year, 4.5% loan for all of you. And secondly, one of the problems which has disturbed people in housing for the last 10, 20, 30 years is the fact that we have income segregation in housing, that low-income families are put in one section, middle-income families in another, luxury apartments in another, and this is un-American, in my opinion. We want our communities to live together, to work together, and to play together. And therefore, ladies and gentlemen, this year an experiment has been tried, and in the middle-income housing projects financed by the Housing Finance Agency, 20% of the apartments will be available for low-income families, and they will be subsidized, not the apartment, but the family. And as their earnings goes up, the subsidy goes down, and they remain in the apartment as part and parcel of the whole program and an integrated community. And lastly, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to state that during these past 3 years, the state has eliminated by law discrimination in housing, both public and private, so that all Americans have equal opportunity in housing. And I should like to pledge to you that I will not quit this job of seeing to it that housing is available, decent, wonderful housing is available for every citizen of the great Empire State in our cities. Thank you very much indeed.
Governor Nelson Rockefeller at the dedication of the Penn South Co-op Apartments in Chelsea on May 19th, 1962. And this was such a big deal that, believe it or not, the President of the United States attended the event too. The president was John F. Kennedy, and he began with a reference to the weather and the sponsorship of the event by the Ladies Garment Workers Union.
I want to register an official protest with the International Ladies Garment Workers at the sweatshop conditions under which we're working today. I'm not sure, but this represents 50 years of progress. It is true that your distinguished president invited me to come to speak on November 3rd as we were heading to a meeting which he was sponsoring 3 days before election. I would have agreed to anything.
So much for the joke. The rest of Kennedy's remarks were classic JFK inspirational talk. They're so interesting that I thought we would play 3 minutes of this for you. And he was such a great speechmaker. And what a contrast with today, as the President of the United States doesn't only praise the unions who are among his core supporters, but he asks for more from them to act for the common good, not just their own interest.
The work available for organized labor in the United States today is just as important, in many ways more important than it was 25 years ago. And this housing project demonstrates what labor, good, effective, progressive leadership, and the city, and the state, and private groups, and the federal government, together in cooperation, can do for this city and this country. And that's why I think it most appropriate to come here today with your distinguished leaders and tell you that this union has done a good job, and to ask that other unions across the country imitate your example. The unfinished business of this country is your business. And I can assure you, after being in the presidency only 16 or 17 months, that the progress of this country will depend in a great measure on the sense of public responsibility of members of organized labor. If you want to have equal opportunity for all Americans, if we want to rebuild our cities, if we want to provide transit in and out of our cities, if we want to educate our children, if we want to have colleges and universities to which they can go, if we want to have medical schools to train our doctors, if we want to make this country as wonderful a place as it can be for the 300 million people who will live in this country within 40 years, then we have to do our task today. It is the task of every generation to build a road for the next generation. And this housing project, the efforts we're making in this city and state and in the national government, I believe can provide a better life for the people who come after us if we meet our responsibility. There are those who say that the job is done, that the function of the federal government is not to govern, that all the things that had to be done were done in the 30s and the 40s. And that now our task is merely to administer. I do not accept that view at all. Nor can any American who sees what we still have left to do. So this is a great effort by you. This union deserves the heartiest commendation. I hope others will follow your example. And I come here today and ask you to continue to work as you have in the past, and as free labor organizations must do all over the world, for the kind of progress upon which our ultimate security depends. We believe that there is much left to do, and I come here today and ask you to join us in doing it. About 30 years ago, a distinguished French marshal asked his gardener to plant a tree, and the gardener said, "That tree won't come to flower for 100 years. He said, "In that case, plant it this afternoon." Well, that's the way I feel about all the tasks left undone in this country, which will not be finished in our time. But we ought to do something about it this afternoon. Thank you.
President John F. Kennedy at the dedication of the Penn South Co-op apartment complex in Chelsea on May 19th, 1962. This is our People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition, here on The Brian Lehrer Show. Now let's get to the issue that these historical sound bites set up, the co-opization and condoization of New York. With me for this is Matthew Lassner, Associate Professor of Urban Studies and Planning at Hunter College, author of High Life, Condo Living in the Suburban Century, published in 2012, and co-editor of Affordable Housing in New York, The People, Places, and Policies That Transformed a City, published in 2015. Professor Lassner, thank you so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
And quite a different time, 1962, with the Republican governor promising more subsidized housing and the Democratic president asking unions to do more for the common good. What did you think listening to those clips?
It's a sober reminder of how things have changed over the last several decades. It was a very different city and a very different national political climate.
So what was the role of unions in creating Penn South as a co-op apartment complex? It seems quaint by today's real estate sensibilities. What would unions have had to do with it or other co-ops?
When the sort of nonprofit co-op movement first emerged, and it emerged in the Jewish community, it emerged in a community of Finnish immigrants in Brooklyn. This is just around the time of World War I, 1910s, 1920s, unions very quickly came to the fore. They came to the fore in the movement because of the sort of political commitment, the constituency of members who needed decent housing, and they also came to play a large role because they had money. They had the resources of the union members, particularly through savings and credit unions and that kind of thing, which they could invest in real estate. After World War II, there is a massive housing shortage. I think that most listeners are probably aware of. This is the era when FHA started subsidizing massive suburbs like Levittown, and also we see the introduction of urban redevelopment or urban renewal, aided by federal grants starting in the late 1940s. And Robert Moses is really the link between the unions and projects like Penn South. Robert Moses' goal was to make use of these federal monies coming online for urban redevelopment projects. And he was not, he did not subscribe to the sort of politics of the cooperative movement, but he saw that the unions, led in particular by Abe Kazin, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America, which had built a couple big cooperative projects in the Bronx and in Manhattan in the late 1920s and early 1930s. And he understood that this was a man, this was an organization. The unions generally were an institution that could get things done. And he approached Kazin and said, how would you like some land provided through urban renewal to build a larger project than you've ever been able to do before? And sort of the rest is history, as it were. The unions had the skill, the dedication, the resources to get projects done. They had members who could buy the apartments, tenant these buildings, run them well, and a fairly happy partnership. There's some caveats that we can talk about later, but a fairly happy and prolific partnership emerged between the city, the federal government, and the large trade unions, and that continued through the 50s into the 60s. And in many respects, Penn South represented a culmination of that model, the power of the state, the power of the unions, the power of self-help, coming together to produce. You may not think Penn South is beautiful, but certainly compared to the kind of housing that union members were living in before, a fantastic project that really genuinely improved the lives of its cooperators, as they were called.
So co-ops were supposed to be something different than they became. Now they're just people buying apartments, not much different from condos for the most part. But then there was supposed to be some real notion of cooperative community behind the financing of them and attached to a notion of price-limited affordability?
Absolutely. It's a little bit tricky because when the idea and the legal mechanism of the co-op emerged in the 19th century, the term was used in all sorts of ways by all sorts of people. And in fact, the very first housing cooperatives were middle-class buildings. This is in the 1880s in Manhattan, groups of really kind of professional families getting together, frustrated with the high cost of rent, complaints that would be familiar to any New Yorker today. And they decided to get together and finance their own buildings and to own them cooperatively. And that's the sort of roots of the market rate co-op that we think of today when we think of when we hear about $30 million co-ops on Park Avenue.
Right. So
what the unions were doing really comes out of the international consumers cooperative movement. So you think about the Park Slope Food Co-op or REI, sort of that model. It was a very different origin.
I rented in Chelsea for a while in a building near Penn South that was a rent-stabilized building, and then it went co-op. And one of the old renters who lived there was sneering at it. He said, "This isn't a co-op. A co-op is supposed to be something where people live together and make a special kind of community. This is just private apartment sales." So it changed at some point. Why were co-ops the thing for a while, though? And then condo apartments started coming into vogue.
Sure. You know, these are just two of actually an array of kind of private contractual arrangements that we can use to co-own real estate. I know I'm probably sounding a little bit using some obscure terminology here, but people in various places have been trying to split up ownership of buildings for hundreds of years, and the origins of the condo system we can see going back as early as the 12th century. In parts of Central Europe. There was no tradition of this in Britain or the U.S., no tradition of it in English common law. So when the first New York families decided that this was something worth pursuing in the late 19th century, rather than go to the trouble of dividing up the building into cubes of air as we do in a condominium and getting the city to go along with it and tax each apartment separately, that sort of thing. What they did was they set up a system of corporate title ownership where there's one legal owner and then ownership of the individual apartments is achieved through what are called proprietary leases, sort of permanent leases. And that model worked for decades. But as we see an explosion in co-ownership in this country in the 50s and 60s, mortgage bankers in particularly were looking to Europe and Latin America and the condominium system, which is a little bit more, again, independent and easier for individuals to get financing. So they imported the condominium system. Something else to add is in the workers' co-op movement, as you mentioned before, we start to see, especially after World War II, the introduction of restrictions on resales, restriction on incomes, you know, making the model explicitly about providing for middle and low income families. The condominium system makes that much more difficult to do. So we see this kind of emergence of certainly luxury co-ops, but the resale restricted co-ops on the one hand, and then kind of market rate condominiums on the other.
So the original co-ops like Penn South were specifically to make housing or ownership more affordable. How much has there been a co-op and condoization of New York to the detriment of affordable housing? I mentioned I once lived in a middle-class targeted rent-stabilized apartment building that then went condo. This was a different one than the Chelsea one I referred to before, which had gone co-op. This was a rent-stabilized building that was built specifically to be middle-class housing, and then it went condo, and now that's a luxury building. So how much has that happened the last few decades, and what effect has it had on the affordable housing supply overall?
These are great questions, and I wish I had the data to give you. Unfortunately, the data doesn't exist, but what I will say is that what we see beginning in the 40s and 50s and early 60s is a majority of rental buildings in middle-class neighborhoods starting to convert to ownership. It starts on the Upper East Side, and then by the 60s and 70s, the Upper West Side, and then we move into the 70s and 80s and Greenwich Village and Park Slope and other areas of the city. And we've continued to see a gradual attrition of rental units. And it happened because there's demand for ownership. It's happened because in a sort of upper middle class buildings, there was some frustration with rent control. This is before rent stabilization, when landlords started to neglect their buildings. Some buildings, tenants got together and wanted to buy the landlords out. And then when we start to see the city recover by the 1980s, it's just a kind of speculative frenzy that emerges. Again, it certainly tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of units, rental units were lost through these conversions over the decades. And again, for the most part, these have been market rate conversions. So we're seeing an absolute loss of units that otherwise would have been affordable under rent control or rent stabilization, at least for a time. But as you know, we're bleeding rent control and rent stabilized units too now.
We sure are. In fact, let me throw out a stat. I guess this is a main reason. The co-opization and condoization of New York is one of the main reasons that when we hear something like the de Blasio housing plan, he says 200,000 units of affordable housing created or preserved. And when you look more closely, only 80,000 of the units are new. The other 120,000 are being what they call preserved. That is, government has to intervene to stop massive losses of affordable apartments to market rates. And a lot of that is co-op and condoization.
Some of it is co-op and condoization. The bulk of it, though, is part of it is co-op and condoization. Part of it is units simply because of the way rent stabilization is structured, pricing out of that program. When rents get to $2,700, depending on the income of the tenants, those units get liberated from rent controls. Another big part of it is already subsidized units graduating out of their obligations to remain affordable. The way these are all privately owned affordable apartments. We're not talking about NYCHA buildings leaving the public housing system. And when we see privately built affordable housing, this goes back to the 50s and 60s, the way the sort of stick to keep them affordable is the underlying mortgages, which tend to be given by the city, state, or federal government, that require a certain degree of affordability until the mortgages are paid off. So when those loans hit 40 years or whatever the expiration is, then buildings are free to go market rate. And that's what we've seen, not at Penn South. And Penn South tenants have voted three times since the 1980s to remain affordable. But many other buildings built under similar programs from this era, from the 50s, from the 60s, as their mortgages are paid off, are choosing to go market rate. So that's where the real losses are, especially in a lot of the Mitchell Lama buildings or in projects like Stuyvesant Town. So this is where the mayor, and again, the strategy goes back really to even the 1980s with the city intervening to extend subsidies. Typically by offering an extended period of tax abatements or maybe new loans to repair the roof or mechanical systems in return for staying affordable for another 20 years, 30 years. But it's one step forward, two steps back, as you say.
We're in our series, A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition, here on The Brian Lehrer Show with today Matthew Lassner, urban studies and planning professor at Hunter College and author of books including High Life, Condo Living in the Suburban Century, as we talk about the co-opization and condoization of New York. And Judy and Chelsea across the street from Penn South, she says. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Well, there's an interesting footnote that lives on the Politics Make Strange Bedfellows front. Saul Alinsky was called in by a number of community groups to stop Penn South, and they were upset about the eminent domain that was going to take place. In other words, tenement buildings and some brownstones and businesses were going to be wiped out. And, in fact, they were. So Alinsky stayed here for quite some time and built up a head of steam, but ultimately didn't get anywhere. So they're, you know, ultimately having Penn South having been built, on the whole, a great thing. But there were affordable apartments that were just wiped clean.
Right. As we talked about earlier this week in some of the other history segments that we've done, Robert Moses, a leader of this, even Mayor LaGuardia, a leader of bulldozing tenements, and with mixed results in terms of how we look back on that now, even though they thought they were doing what they called slum clearance in pursuit of better housing for more people. So thank you for that. One more call. Jim in Morris Township, you're on WNYC.
Yeah,
hi, Jim.
I lived in Manhattan beginning 68. I had a rent control apartment. And I remember the rent, the cooperative, I think it was cooperative movement, changing, because before then it had been a device for tenants to seize control of their buildings and run it for themselves. But then I guess the state began from pressure from the real estate industry that wanted to get rid of rent control, rent stabilized apartments, to lower the number of tenants who had to sign up for a cooperative for it to take place. So it got to be so low that landlords could go around and pick off a minority of tenants. And then suddenly the whole building was going co-op.
Yeah, the co-op conversion or condo conversion only needed a certain percentage of the rent-stabilized tenants to approve it in order for that transition to happen. That's a good historical point. So let's end on something related to that, Professor Lassner. This series is A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition. How does the co-op and condoization of the city reflect who has power and who doesn't to affect the housing landscape?
Power lies with money today. In the 1960s, when we still had a huge number of blue-collar jobs, which were unionized, the unions were able to have an important seat at the table. But as industry has suburbanized or moved to the south or offshore, and the city has been increasingly divided between sort of menial service workers on the one hand and well-to-do professionals on the other, the balance of power has absolutely shifted away from the ordinary man and woman to those with money.
And we leave it there with Matthew Lassner, urban studies and planning professor at Hunter College, author of books including High Life, Condo Living in the Suburban Century, and Affordable Housing in New York, The People, Places, and Policies That Transformed a City. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My next guest was Hillary Clinton's email director. I know what you're thinking, but it's not that. She was the email director for the campaign. And after the campaign ended, as Amanda Littman writes in her new book, she was, quote, angry at a system that makes it so hard to run for office and at a party that perpetually encouraged rich lawyers to run and then seemed shocked to find itself without a diverse pipeline of talent. So she decided to do something about it. She co-founded a political action committee called Run for Something, dedicated to helping progressives under 35 to run for office. Amanda Littman is here with me now. Her new book is called Don't Just March, Run for Something, A Real Talk Guide to Fixing the System Yourself. Hi, Amanda. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Why'd you write the book?
Because this didn't exist. When we started Run for Something, we were looking for a guide we could send to people, something that was approachable and readable and actually actionable, and nothing was there. You know, I Googled as hard as I could find. So taking a little bit of my own advice, I decided to do something about it.
And the book and the organization are mostly about encouraging people who are progressive Democrats mm-hmm. under 35 to run for office and then guiding them through the process. Now, a lot of young people might not have the confidence to run or feel that they're qualified yet. So who in that group should actually run for office? What qualifies a person under 35 to run, in your opinion?
Well, I think the important thing to keep in mind is that Donald Trump is president, and inevitably you are smarter and kinder and know more about policy and are better connected to your community than he could ever possibly be. So you are, by nature of being better than him, qualified to run for local office. You don't need a lot of money. You don't need political experience. All you really need is a commitment to solving a problem and a commitment to doing the work.
Charisma, personality, and ability to insult your opponent?
Bingo.
Yes?
No, I think charisma is important. Having a good personal story is important. But we've elected a lot of people without charisma in American politics. What really matters is that you're running for a position that lets you solve a problem you care about.
Michael Dukakis got all the way to Democratic nominee. If you are thinking about running for office, listeners, or if you've thought about it but haven't really actively considered it, but thought, well, you know, maybe I should, maybe I might, maybe I would, maybe I want to. Or if you're actually running for office as a first-time candidate for something, and it could be as low a level of office as anything, give us a call now with your questions for our guest, Amanda Littman, who's written a detailed guide for novice candidates called Don't Just March, Run for Something, A Real Talk Guide to Fixing the System Yourself. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And to what degree, because some people may be thinking, oh, God, well, you know, what's really going to make a difference if the issue is fighting Trump? It's really only going to make a difference if I get elected to Congress.
Mm-mm-mm.
But you're in the complete opposite place to that, right?
Yeah, I mean, Congress is really important because the only way that Trump will ever get impeached is through electing a Democratic Congress. So yes, that matters. However, look at who's leading the resistance these days. It's mayors who are making their cities sanctuary cities. It's city councils that are protecting healthcare centers. It is school boards that are making sure that trans kids in their schools have, you know, equality and the rights that they deserve. Yes, Congress matters, but for the fights that really impact your day-to-day life, it's local, local, local.
School board.
Love them. School board is amazing. Two fun facts. One, school boards are some of the most representative bodies of government. 44% of school board members are women. Second fun fact, I believe it is 75% of school board races cost $1,000 or less, 85% cost $5,000 or less. So you can afford to run for school board.
District leader.
Amazing. You should do it. Especially if you want to fix the Democratic Party, you should run for a party position. It is not enough to complain about the system. You got to join it and become the decision maker.
Tony in Fort Lee, you're on WNYC with Amanda Littman. Hi.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Amanda. And I applaud Amanda for stepping up and writing that book. I'm a former elected official myself. I've run from everything for school board, like she's saying, all the way up to state office and former councilman. But what she's, and I don't mean this to be antagonizing, but what you're not mentioning is, you know, you could have $1 billion, hence Michael Bloomberg, but you need the party machine. You need the troops. You need that machine. So it is intimidating, and even though you might be well-intentioned and, you know, be very morally a good person and a nice person and a hard worker, that's important, but you really need that army. You need that machine to know what to file, when to file, where to go, what to say, when to say it, who to contact. So school board is, yeah, that might be able to be done on your own. I know I ran for school board. I still had the Republican machine behind me. But other than that, yeah, you're going to need some serious firepower. You're going to need people who just know the ins and the outs, hence why Michael Bloomberg, again, very, very billionaire, could have done it himself, he had to choose a party. You have to. You need that machine.
You don't actually disagree with Tony that much, right?
No, I actually do agree. You need the machine, and one of the things that my organization, Run for Something, tries to be is grease the wheels so you have an entry point into the machine and you know who to ask and how to get access to the voter file and who the right printers are in your area, so you make sure you're using the union printer if that's something that's important to you, that kind of thing. But I will say, the entry point into the machine is by running for local office.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, you should not expect to win your first race, but it's not Election Day is not the end of your civic engagement. It's the beginning, regardless of what happens.
Tony, good point. Thank you. Michael in Garden City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Ms. Lippman. So my question is, you know, a lot of young people, myself included, I'm 23, we've kind of felt that, you know, the two parties that currently dominate American politics, they don't really represent the more diverse views that we have. You know, obviously the progressive movement with Sanders this year, kind of the growing rise of libertarians. So what do you think about the fact that a lot of young people might be more inclined to run on a third party ticket than with the parties that have the machines that you just mentioned?
If that's what you feel compelled to do, you should do it. I would never discourage someone from running outside the party system. I will say there's a lot of benefits to running within one of the parties. And by joining it and proudly declaring a platform and a mission, you can shift the party in the direction that you want. My personal opinion, the best way to fix the Democratic Party is to join it and change it from within.
Michael, thank you. Lisa in Mendham, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me. I am one of the many candidates, one of the many women who was upset when we saw Hillary Clinton lose in 2016. And so I decided to run for office, and I've never run for office before. And I'm really calling in to encourage, just like your author, Amy, has said, to encourage everyone from doing it. To encourage everyone to do it, because I've never run before and I've had tremendous support. I didn't understand all of the things that you're speaking about in your book, but there were plenty of organizations that were ready to support me. I'm running for New Jersey State Senate. My county party was ready to support me, and I learned as I went, and I think that that's really the best way to do it.
That's amazing. Good luck with your campaign. You must be up in the election very soon.
5 weeks.
Lisa, thank you very much. Here's another candidate, Marnie in Chelsea. You're on WNYC. Hi, Marnie.
Yes. Hi, thanks for taking my call. My name is Marnie Halassa. I'm running for City Council District 3 against a very entrenched Democrat, Cory Johnson. And I just wanted to say, you know, as a third party and as an independent running, I find it extremely difficult as well. You know, when I try to solicit organizations for help, like Eleanor's Legacy and Emily's List, I mean, they're excited that I'm a woman of color and I'm running, but, you know, they basically have told me, well, you're not a Democrat. So what I just wanted to ask, you know, I have an interesting perspective. I have something, good to add to the political equation, and I just feel I'm sort of, you know, almost like shut out. How does a third party or an independent actually get help?
Well, I think that's one of the downsides of running as an independent. You are independent from the system. There's literally not a party to support you. That being said, I don't ever sugarcoat this idea that running for office is easy. It is really hard. However, it is not inaccessible, and you know that by the fact that you're doing it. So good luck with your campaign.
I mean, it'd be interesting. I mean, the same sort of women causes that the Democrats, you know, support. I mean, I support also, you know, smashing the glass ceiling, reproductive rights. What I was trying to do is almost like encourage, you know, these groups. Like, listen, I have similarly aligned issues with you. You know, I just wanted to ask, what do you think about that?
Well, those groups have their missions that they're trying to stick with, so I can understand, even if it's frustrating, why they might be saying no. I am sure there are groups that are there to support women like you, though, although I wish I knew some off the top of my head.
Marnie, for you, why run as a third-party candidate? Why not? It sounds like your values pretty much align with the progressive...
Me, honestly, I got really mad at the Democrats for what they did to Bernie Sanders, so I changed my party affiliation to the Green Party. But I came a little bit too late to petitioning, so that's why I had to run as an independent.
Right.
You know, I also actually, even though it's really hard, I mean, I love the process. I love meeting people in my community. So I would also encourage people to run, but just that they have an uphill battle, and, you know, the fundraising is crazy. Mm-hmm. It's crazy, but, you know, you got to do what you got to do. If you feel like you want to do it, you should do it.
Thank you for your call, and good luck out there. And Amanda, especially in local primaries, the small number of people who actually vote tend to be older. So how can the younger candidates who you're interested in encouraging into the field connect with and earn the trust of voters who might be part of their parents' or grandparents' generations, but really hold the key to their potential elections?
Knock on doors. There is no app, there is no tweet, there is no email that can make up for a one-on-one personal connection with a voter. So if you're thinking about running for office, lace up your shoes. You're going to be knocking doors for a very long time. And it's an incredibly fun experience.
And I'll call this the, oh, it's like a college application question. People under 35 have been regularly using social media since college or well before that. You know, what do you say to people worried that Facebook photos from their raucous college days or whatever will be unearthed by opposition researchers?
That's probably true. And if more people who have those kinds of Facebook photos and, you know, scandalous tweets are running, we sort of normalize that. I will also, again, say you've never tweeted anything as dumb as what Donald Trump has tweeted, so you're probably fine.
I'm still thinking about Marnie's call and the fact that she's up against an incumbent in her district. And you point out in the book that 90% of incumbents win their reelection campaigns. Mm-hmm. So those are always tough races. Should first-time candidates avoid them and find more of an opening than challenging an incumbent for a first race?
Well, I think when you're running in a primary against an incumbent, you or an open seat, you need to be able to make a positive message as to why your vision and your goals for your community are the right way. I would never encourage someone to run in a primary to be negative, especially within the Democratic Party. But if you have something that you care about, don't shy away from it just because you might not win. It's still worth getting in the fight. And I think Marnie said that pretty straightforwardly.
And I'll give you a specific example that's news today. A young political journalist who we've had as a guest on the show, Ross Barkin, announced yesterday he's running as a Democrat for a New York State Senate seat in southern Brooklyn against the Republican incumbent Marty Golden, who's been there for a long time. This is for next year's elections. Mm-hmm. That's when the New York State Legislature is up. And I don't know if Barkin would need to run in a Democratic primary first. Maybe there are other people interested in that nomination. I don't know. But the Daily News asked Senator Golden about the prospect of Barkin, and he said, quote, "There's nothing to say. Nobody knows him. You have to have some commitment to a community. They wouldn't know him if he was walking down the street. He has no presence in the community whatsoever." Now, Ross Barkin wrote that he's lived most of his life in Bay Ridge, in the district. But is his case hopeless, like the current state senator said? Or how do you fight that? What he's really boiling it down to is public name recognition.
Public name recognition matters, but I would expect that Ross will be knocking doors and making calls and talking to voters every night and every weekend from now until the primary and through to the election if he makes it, because that is how you convince people. And I would imagine that the incumbent Republican state senator is feeling the heat, because for now, he's going to have to work to win his reelection. You know, that's one of the best things about running against an incumbent. Win or lose, they probably haven't felt the heat in a while.
Amy in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Amy.
Yeah, hi, Brian. Thanks for doing this. And I've worked on a number of campaigns. And my view is that you really have to galvanize the community, and you have to consider what's the most important issues within the community. You don't work top down, you work from bottom up. And you have to have a long view of things. You have to really start years in advance. And then you use things that really don't cost money, which is social media. But you really have to grow your own. You have to grow your own base, because without it, you're just not going to be elected, you know. And part of that is voter registration as well. So you do good. You register voters. And that also sometimes becomes your base as well. And you also have to have the individuals who will work around whatever issue it is, whether it's taxes, health care, better education, because that's being realistic. And whether you win or lose, you will have changed your community, because your issues often then rise to the top and then are addressed. So it's a win-win all the way.
You are singing my song, girl. It's exactly right. It doesn't necessarily matter what happens on election day. The act of campaigning alone can make a huge difference in your community.
Amy, thank you so much. How about money? A lot of people, I think especially under 35, because maybe they're not as jaded mm-hmm. as people who are older, cringe at the idea of doing political fundraising, which seems so gross and corrupting even when it's legal, and just like don't want to, you know, get their hands dirty with that bacteria. what do you say about that?
Well, asking for money as part of politics for now, we can put aside for a moment whether it's a good or a bad thing, is part of the system. But you're not asking someone to loan you money for lunch or buy you dinner. You're asking someone to invest in their community and in the vision that you guys share. And this is a little bit of an idealistic thing, but I think fundraising for a political campaign is a little bit of a public service in that you give people a way to channel their enthusiasm. You know, think about what happened after the Muslim ban. People threw money at the ACLU. We throw money at Planned Parenthood because it makes us feel good. We can do the same where if I care about the schools in my town, I can throw money at a school board candidate.
But then with the exception of the Bernie Sanders campaign and some other notable ones, so much of the money that's actually available, especially that's the bigger money, is special interested money that may not be cause oriented, but this corporation or that industry or whatever.
Yeah, but most races don't need that much money. You know, school board races are cheap. State legislative races outside of maybe New York City are pretty cheap. We're seeing now in Virginia a really good House of Delegates race is raising $200,000 over the course of an election. Yeah, it's a lot of
money,
but it's not that much money. You'd be surprised at how cheap these things are.
10 seconds. Is it happening? Is there an actual surge of candidates since the election?
11,000 young people and counting have signed up to run through runforsomething.net.
And we leave it there for today with Amanda Litman, co-founder with Ross Morales Rocchetto of a political action committee called Run for Something, dedicated to helping progressives under 35 to run for office. And Amanda's new book is called Don't Just March, Run for Something, a real talk guide to fixing the system yourself. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest is a former professional football player and coach. She played in both men's and women's leagues and was the first woman to coach in the NFL. The Arizona Cardinals hired her in 2015 as an assistant coach during training camp and preseason. She also holds a PhD in sports psychology. Her name is Jen Welter, and she's written a book now called Play Big, Lessons in Being Limitless from the First Woman to Coach in the NFL. Hi, Dr. Welter, welcome to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Can you tell us first about your own path to first women's professional football leagues? How'd you get there, and why did you decide to play football of all sports?
I grew up in a small town where football is like a way of life, and I was enchanted by them as a little kid. Like, I would watch them, and I'm like, oh my gosh, those are like real-life superheroes. And I never had an opportunity to play. I was an undersized, probably underestimated athlete most of my career who found that I could be a lot bigger within a team. I was a tennis player first, and my coach told me because of my size and my build, I'd never be strong enough to play pro tennis. You know, and I tell that story because maybe he was right. I grew up to play pro football instead. And that's the power of team sports to me, is that, you know, we have different places for different people, and you don't have to be the answer in and of yourself. You can find a place where you're bigger.
And forgive me for not knowing much about those leagues, but I don't think I'm alone. Why do you think they haven't caught on at all with the public? People know the WNBA. People know women's soccer. Just sticking with the team sports, of course people know women tennis players and to some degree the LPGA. You can find softball on ESPN now, but not women's football.
No, and women's football is hopefully just now breaking into the scene a little bit more. And having been someone who was in the trenches a long time, I think part of breaking through that was actually the conversation that surrounded when I went into men's professional football. When I played on the men's team, all of a sudden people want to know, well, wait, girls can't play football. Where'd she come from? You know, and they started to be like, oh, well, there's women's football. But it was still, that was a murmur, right? Like maybe a dull whisper. And then all of a sudden when I went to the Cardinals, it was like people were like, wait, where does this come from? And we didn't know women played. And they started to realize that there was this whole community of women who were playing football and playing darn good football, if I might say. And it still needs a lot more love. Everybody should check out your local women's team. But what needs to happen is that at times, I mean, there's 80 tackle football teams across the country. And so for it to go to the next level, there need to be some more dollars behind it so that the truly elite players can not just be found regionally, but put together collectively to field the most competitive teams. And then you start to see those games go to the level that they can be. And then you can do things like television contracts. And
listeners, if you have a question for Jen Welter, who is the first female coach in the NFL, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Her new book is called Play Big, Lessons in Being Limitless, from the first woman to coach in the NFL. So when you were hired by the Arizona Cardinals to be a coach, what barriers did you have to break through for your coaching to be accepted by the players?
You know, I was really blessed in the situation I went into. And I think that it was set up in advance before I went in the best way possible. And I tell this example because for any of you listening, whether it's football or another business, if you're going to make a change, like hiring a first, and I don't care what that first is, okay, and you're going to be bold enough to do it, you can also help secure your success by kind of following the roadmap that Bruce Arians laid out. And I love, because him and I went back and we talked about it. And when he was hiring me, he said, you know, I don't know yet, or when we talked about him possibly hiring me, he said, I don't know yet if I can make this happen. I have to get all the right yeses. And, but I want you to know it's in my heart to try. And so the yeses that Bruce started with were actually, he went to the players first. And he talked to his players and said, this is something I'm thinking about doing. What do you think? Right? So we already had buy-in from the players to then move it up the chain of command and talk to Steve Keim and talk to Michael Bidwell, you know, to say, this is something we would like to do as a team.
And was it to break a barrier, or was he certain just trying to staff his coaching staff with, you know, different coaches have different skills, and you had a particular skill that was better than any other applicants for that role on the coaching staff?
I think it was a little bit of both, because you have to be willing to realize the implications, right? You're not doing that in the dark. It's not an either or situation, because you are taking a stand when you're hiring a first, or when you are being a first. And you have to realize also that it's going to be more complicated and difficult than just staffing people with equal skill sets because of the media buzz that was going to be around it. There's no way to think that it wasn't, right? It was going to create some chaos, right? And he actually said that. And that is one of the biggest fears that NFL teams have, because it's so tight. And it's, you know, we don't want things to be a distraction. So I think he was aware and cognizant of all of that, and yet was confident that it would work with me, partially because of my playing career and passion, but also because of the degree in psychology. So that added another element to the staff.
The interest in avoiding distractions. With your experience, I wonder if you have a unique take on the kneeling controversy that's going on right now.
You know, it's a hard one. And, you know, to me as a player, I might have not known at one point which way to go because of my personal history, right? My dad's a Vietnam vet, and he has a silver star and two bronze stars. And I remember asking about it when it first happened. And he said, I don't like it. Just, you know, he was kind of visceral. And then when we talked a little further, he kind of softened a little bit. And he's like, but that is what we fought for. You know, this is the United States of America, and we should all have the right to protest. And so I think it's brave of anybody in any situation to take a stand. But I also see that the flag itself is something that people are going to be upset about, right? And it should never have gotten to the breaking point where they were pushed to say, if you take a knee, you should be fired, because now you're saying you don't deserve freedom. And now you're not even protesting by taking a knee for what you originally did, right? Now you're taking a knee because somebody just called you out.
And is that why what a lot of teams are doing now is linking arms but standing during the national anthem so they can make the statement simultaneously that they respect the flag, but they're protesting Trump saying that players who do take a knee should be fired?
Yeah, they're trying to find a middle ground, because really, and I've talked to some of the guys who have kneeled, and I know them, and none of them wanted to disrespect, like it had nothing to do with disrespecting the flag. And so that was where, you know, otherwise you would have every guy in the NFL who would do it. No question, no doubt. I could tell you that. Nobody would agree with racial injustice or telling people they don't have a right to protest. The challenge came in with the flag element. I actually thought Jerry Jones was probably the smartest one.
The owner of the Dallas Cowboys,
because he had the entire team take a knee and stand for the flag.
Yes.
Because Jerry is somebody, and that's why he's like the ultimate businessman swag. He was like, wait a minute. It doesn't have to be an either or. You said take a knee and stand for the flag. So he took a knee and stood for the flag.
Very smart. Jen Welter, my guest, she was the first female coach in the NFL with the Arizona Cardinals in 2015. She's got a new book called Play Big, Lessons in Being Limitless from the First Woman to Coach in the NFL. Our phone number is 212-433-WNYC. And William in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Jen Welter. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Ms. Welter, great job. And appreciate just, you know, that you're there. Keep on keeping on. I just wanted to speak. There is a women's professional league that's been in play for almost 20 years. And they got about maybe at least 20 teams around the country. In fact, it's right here in New York City. They play in Brooklyn. They used to play in Monsignor Farrell on Staten Island. They're called the New York Sharks.
Yeah, I know. I played in the women's league, and I know a lot of the girls as the Sharks. That's what we were talking about.
So, William,
I just shouted them out.
So, William, you're just giving a shout out that this exists and go see them?
Absolutely. They play at Floyd Bennett Field. I believe they usually start, between.
This is the off season right now. They play in the spring.
Right.
That's a spring league.
It's nice, you know, and it's fun. I mean, you can always get a seat. I would hope more people will come out. And Ms. Walter, being you're there, maybe you can help maybe find some sponsorships or get more drive, some more shout-outs, some more along the line.
Right. And William,
on air.
Thank you very much. All right. There's at least one fan calling in of the women's New York City football team known as the Sharks. And we'll continue with Jen Walter and more of your calls right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Jen Welter, the first female coach in the NFL. She did that with the Arizona Cardinals in 2015. She's the author now of a book called Play Big, Lessons in Being Limitless from the first woman to coach in the NFL. And the title sounds like what it is. To some degree, this is a motivational, inspirational book, and you do motivational speaking. You want to talk about the philosophy behind the title, Play Big?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, at 5'2", 130 pounds, it took me a while to realize that in the game and in life, you don't actually have to be big to play big. You can have a big impact by not only your stat sheets, but how you approach the game, the energy you bring to it, the effect you have on your teammates, and then hopefully in this life through the things that you do, but the ripple effects, right? And how that carries forward. So it has a lot of meanings to me. You know, as a player, I realized I was not going to outbig anybody. And when I became a great player was when I stopped trying to play their game and I owned my own, which was be small and fast and maneuverable and not always take everybody on head on.
So people can do this in business. People can do this in education.
Absolutely.
Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah. And you should, you know, as I say, we all have our own path and we all have our own elements. And for me, people called me crazy my whole life. Right. But it was all of those elements and that whole lot of crazy that made me successful. So I say I love my brand of crazy and I encourage all of you to love yours as well.
Bob in Rego Park, you're on WNYC with Jen Welter. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Brian. How you doing, guy?
Okay.
I'd like to ask a tough question to you, Jen. Given women's football, men's football, the concussions, football players shooting themselves in the head, dying prematurely, would you recommend people playing a game of football, possibly abolishing football, being a psychology person? As much as you love something, to love something that will ultimately cause you to commit suicide, isn't that a problem?
Well, I can tell you've already put quite a bit of thought into this and you have your own perspective, and I also have mine. You know, one of the things that you're seeing is the repercussions of the ineducation of many years in the past. And we've all been very bad at things in the past. Look at smoking. It used to be very prevalent and people did not really understand the health risks. So they did it on a much more frequent basis and you had a lot of people die of cancer in the process. What happens when you realize that you didn't know everything you thought you know is that you have to be better and to come up with plans to move forward. Okay. Since that time, the way and the philosophy surrounding football has fundamentally changed. The game is not played the same way it was back then. We don't think of putting your helmet to somebody's chest as proper tackling form. We're looking at more rugby-style tackling where you're taking the head out of the equation. I personally learned in rugby first. So when you gave me pads and a helmet, I didn't change my tackling form. I was just much smarter about it.
We actually had a guest recently who suggested abolishing helmets for the NFL and college football and making it rugby style in that respect, going all the way to that, and that would actually prevent concussions. What do you think about that?
I wouldn't abolish the helmets. I would have the helmets as a backup plan, right? That's what I learned in football because you have hard substances like pads. Okay, rugby, they don't have football pads and football pads are hard. So what, you want somebody to hit their head on football pads? Doesn't work. You need the helmets, but you need to teach people to tackle without the helmets and to change the mentality behind putting on a helmet and what that means.
So you think the rules can take care of the problem?
I think the coaching can take care of the problem. I think the philosophy can take care of the problem. I also know that there are substitutes like, you know, like Dartmouth is using the mobile tackling dummies. So their players never tackle other football players, which is where you would have more likelihood of having a helmet-to-helmet collision is where you would more likely come out with a concussion. So you're focusing on the fundamentals while minimizing the contact. Did you realize as we have these questions that in regular season, an NFL team can only put their fully pad their players for 14 practices throughout the year?
Because?
To minimize the contact. So much of the game at that level is not about, as they used to say, you know, we're going to go out and bang heads every practice. Okay. The philosophy has changed so much that that's what you have to do. And the technology has gotten better as well.
Let me ask you about something in the news just in the last day. Maybe you know about this. I gather that at a press conference yesterday, a female reporter asked Cam Newton a question. And he responded, "It's funny to hear a female talk about roots." I get R-O-U-T-E-S. I guess she was talking about roots that receivers
take. Running routes.
Take.
You mean
yeah,
routes.
Routes.
Yeah.
And the reporter was pretty offended, needless to say. Do you know about that incident?
I do know about the incident. I also know about Cam Newton as a man in terms of the interactions I've had with him. The first time I met Cam was when he was filming a show that most of you probably don't realize he had, which was all about helping kids achieve their dreams. It was called All In. And there was a little girl named Alaysia who was, her goal was to be the first girl to play football in the NFL. And so what did Cam do? He hired me to come out and help him coach Alaysia in football for the day. And he was wonderful and positive, and he told her she could do anything. When we finished filming the show, you know, Cam kind of looked at me and he smiled. He is a very expressive person, and he is a little bit of an instigator. He's very competitive. And he said, "Coach, I beat your team this year." And I looked at him and I said, "Yeah, I know." And he said, "It was after you weren't there anymore." And I said, "Yeah, I know." He said, "So what would you have done differently to beat me?" And I said, "Do you really want to know?" And he's like, "Yeah, I do. I want to see what you got." And I said, "Well, I would have put a lot of pressure on the outside contain to keep you in the pocket because you don't like to be there. Your legs are a weapon. I would have probably done some delayed twist stunts with my spy who was keying on you through the middle. And oh, by the way, I would have jammed up your tight end Olsen so that you had nobody to pass it to, and I would have forced you to beat me on the outside."
So after Cam Newton had an interaction like that with you, how do you square that with him turning around and saying it's funny to hear a female talk about some other detail of the game?
What I can square with him on that is that I can't speak to everything or everybody, which none of us can. Any one of us taking one sentence out of comment or out of context could look like a jerk. And again, I don't like the comment. But what I do know is after that, what Cam said to me is, "Well, Coach, maybe you should have still been there, because with that game plan, you guys might have had a shot." And after that day, Cam has been an advocate for me ever since.
And we leave it there for today. My guest has been Dr. Jen Welter, a former professional football player and the first woman to coach in the NFL. Her new book is called Play Big, Lessons in Being Limitless. From the first woman to coach in the NFL, she does motivational speaking. She's organizing a flag football league for girls and other things like that, as well as now this book tour. Thank you for making us one of your stops.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.